This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, Christopher Coyne was installed as the 10th bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington. Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano serves as the Pope's representative to the United States, and he performed the rite of installation for Bishop Coyne.
Are you willing to serve the people of this diocese in the tradition of the apostolic faith of the Church?
With faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, and with the love of God in my heart, I do accept the pastoral care of the people of God in the Diocese of Burlington. I resolve to serve faithfully the spiritual needs of this local church.
And the needs of the church are many. The Catholic Diocese of Burlington sold off two significant parcels of land a few years ago to pay for lawsuits stemming from clergy child abuse cases. And while there are more than 100,000 Catholics in Vermont, only about a quarter of them actually attend Mass. And the bishop has ideas about how to strengthen the church's social mission to help the poor as well. Today on Vermont Edition, we are joined by Bishop Christopher Coyne. Welcome and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Was this new position something that you sought out, or do bishops get assigned without regard to where they might like to be in the world?
We normally get asked whether we'd be willing to take on a ministry. And so I received the phone call from Archbishop Vigano to come to Burlington, and I have the right to say yes or no. And so I said he asked me, and I said yes. And he said, "Well, don't you want to pray about it?" And I said, "Give me 2 seconds." I said yes.
Why? Why Vermont? Why is that something that was appealing to you?
Well, I'm from New England originally, and I love the New England folks. And I've had a lot of fun here in Vermont with the times I've come up and gone skiing and hiking. But I also just know that in many ways, Vermont is just kind of a place that is ready for renewal within our church, and there's a lot of goodwill within the community, and I want to work with that.
I want to ask you a serious question before we get started on some of the other issues that we really need to delve into. And as you said, you have strong New England roots. You were also a priest in Boston for many years. So I want to get your thoughts on what was occupying the minds of many of the faithful and many of the non-faithful among us last night. You changed your Facebook cover photo to a picture of Tom Brady. What were you thinking about the big game?
Well, it was touch and go. At the end of the day, I had somebody from another radio station interviewed me yesterday afternoon. They said, "Are you praying for the Patriots?" And I said, "No, I don't need to pray for them. They're going to win." And, you know, then that catch happened, and I said, "Oh, maybe I should have been praying," because it was just like what happened 7 years ago when we were here and David Tyree caught that pass. So,
and there were certainly a lot of tweets suddenly saying that God was not on the side of the Patriots. I have to say, if you were watching Twitter, you saw that.
I did. But then, you know, do you turn around and say he was on our side when they made that awful call to throw a pass on the 1 yard line?
So that is the question.
I know. So we'll have to ask the Lord someday when we face him.
As I just said, you did serve as a priest in Boston for 25 years, and most recently you were auxiliary bishop in Indianapolis for 3 years. How do you get up to speed on the specific dimensions and the sort of dynamics of your congregation and on the position of the Catholic Church in Vermont now that you're here?
Well, I think the most important thing is for me to get out and visit the parishes and agencies and towns, cities, and to meet with folks. I'd like to get there on the weekends and say Mass and then have an open forum for them. We can talk with respectful listening about what we're doing well, what we're not doing well, what people's concerns are, and get a sense of the folks that are here in the state. In many ways, at least geographically, Vermont is very similar to Indianapolis in that the Diocese of Indianapolis basically takes up the whole southern part of Indiana with the core, with the central city at the very top, much like Burlington. And so many times folks felt like the church was too centered around the city and they didn't pay attention to the south and other regions. And I'm hearing that a little bit here in Vermont. So I'm going to make a real effort not to fall into that trap. And so I'm hoping that even this weekend my first move will be either down south for a Mass or to meet people, or even maybe up to the Northeast Kingdom, although it depends on the weather.
There are 73 parishes in Vermont. Some of them are linked together, as I understand it, and about 120 priests, including visiting priests and foreign priests. You've said that you plan to get around the state and visit them. Do you think you'll be able to visit all of the parishes?
I think so. I think because a lot of them are linked, that when I go to a parish, I can have kind of like a common town meeting for all three or four small parishes in one place. But then over the course of a weekend, actually get out and drive to the various chapels and churches and see the folks. No matter where I go, I hope that I will have an hour or two afterwards to just sit and have that open forum. And I'm ready to listen to what people have to say, both the good and the bad, because oftentimes when you listen to people, you get a lot of wisdom and you learn a lot about what really is happening on the ground. And I need to hear that.
We're talking today with the new leader of Vermont's Catholic community, Bishop Christopher Coyne. Listeners, if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We just heard him say he's really hoping to hear from Catholics around the state about what they see as the issues. Now's a good time to get your point across if you have a question for him or a thought. You can also post it at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition. We have a couple of questions from people about priests in Vermont and specifically the priest shortage that many churches are facing. Joyce in Reading says, "Welcome to Vermont. You are daily in my prayers. In light of the priest shortage, will you continue to enlist the help of international priests? Some of our parishes in the diocese are being reconfigured. Is this a model you support?"
I don't have any particular model right now as far as what I would see as a good way to go for the future. So I don't want to say that I think reconfiguration or the use of international priests is the answer. Right now, basically 35% of the priests that are active are under the age of 60. So think about that. In another 10 or 15 years, our numbers are going to be quite stretched. The international priests are doing a great job, and it's good to have them in here to help us cover. I'm not quite sure whether that's the answer either. I think it's more short term. I would hope that as we move forward, we might involve more lay leadership. I'm very open to the idea of lay pastoral associates, men and women who would actually be the pastoral ministers for parishes and make sure that there's worship going on and that there's prayer and that there's that all those things are part of parish life. And then the downside of that is you don't have a regular celebration of what we Catholics consider the most important things, which are the sacraments. But I think –
because only a priest can administer those.
Well, certain ones. You know, deacons can marry. Deacons can baptize. So we need to perhaps expand the use of deacons and more permanent deacons. But I think – I don't really want to close churches or chapels. What we did in Indianapolis was we'd configure parishes and we'd merge them together. But we'd often keep the churches themselves open as chapels so that folks still had some connection and opportunity to use those spaces. But no one wants to close a church. No one wants to close a parish because it's like a death in the family. The people will tell you that my mother was baptized here and married. My family helped pay for this church. And it's really heartbreaking for many people to see that. So I'm hoping we can figure out ways to not close the doors of our churches but keep them open. And as I said in my homily, I want to keep them open and for us to go out and bring more folks back in.
Can you put numbers on the shortage of priests in Vermont? I mean, are we filling those positions with international priests or are there some parishes that just are not being served?
From what I understand, we're right on the edge. We are basically able to cover our needs right now, but our priests are getting older. We've had a number of deaths. I think 7 or 8 retired and older priests passed away this past year, which in terms of the numbers across the board are not that high, but as a percentage of the priests in the diocese, that was about the American-born priests, that was about 10%. So I think if I can encourage more men to see the joy of being a priest and to maybe think about serving and trying to discern whether that's called for them, that's a way to go. But I'm also very open to other ideas of how to continue to maintain our parishes under new leadership.
One of the things that you've already put forward as a priority now that you're the bishop here is getting more people to attend Mass. Mm-hmm. Vermont has, by all accounts, about 118,000 people who identify as Catholic in the state, but only about 28,000 of them actually attend Mass. Why is it important to you that people actually participate in services?
Well, it's a way that we maintain our community. It's for us Catholics, it's the Mass is the central part of our life each and every week when we gather together to worship God. And it's from there that we begin to connect on our lives and go out and spread the good news. The last thing we say is at the Mass is go out and spread the good news. Go out. And that means we're supposed to go out from this place and do the good works of mercy, the works of charity, the works of say the right things to right people for the right reasons, all those things that are part of it. We're nourished there and we move out. I think when I was in the parish in Boston, it was a pastor of parish, and we decided for the first year to kind of maybe do a little bit of house cleaning. And we said, you know, if we're going to invite folks back to our church, we better have something to offer them that's going to keep them here. And so I think part of the work that we're going to have to do as a diocese is to ask ourselves, is this a place that when people walk through the doors, are they going to feel welcome? Are they going to feel part of a community? Are they going to receive something that's going to want to make them stay and something that's going to bring them deeper into the faith of our Catholic community?
Well, to that note, we got a question from Kelly in St. Johnsbury, who says, you say you're going to reach out to Catholics who no longer attend Mass. Is there any plan to reach out to transgender persons who no longer feel welcomed at church?
Well, I'm sorry that that's happened, because I see no reason why transgender people would not be welcome in church. I think there's more and more evidence coming forward that a lot of this is biological, that it's not just something that a person makes as a kind of fashionable choice or cultural choice, but that that transgender people are really struggling with the idea of gender identity, and that they've struggled with it for years. And that's through no fault of their own. And so there's no fault to be made, actually. This is who they are. And I would – you know, it's – there. Everyone is God's creatures, and I would invite anyone to come to the table, and I would hope that none of my priests – most especially myself, would ever say anything that would be hurtful or to transgender folk. At times, I have to personally say, at times I've kind of been uncomfortable because I just don't know how to say he or she or what. It's just getting used to it. It's not because I feel any kind of personal animosity or anything that there's anything wrong. It's just more of what I've been raised in. So if I ever say anything that is some consider insensitive or hurtful, I would hope they'd call me on it and say, you know, you got to be more careful about your language or those things. So Pope Francis just met with a transgender – I think it was male-female, I think. And that to me just shows even that the Pope himself is welcoming of all people of goodwill.
So to Kelly's point, you would welcome transgender people into the church here.
Absolutely. In the same way that I would welcome people who self-identify as gay, lesbian, bi, but also all folks, you know, to come to the church to try and grow in their love for the Lord God and Jesus Christ. But, you know, it's not easy being a Catholic. Our faith is a very demanding faith, and the starting point must be that relationship with Jesus. And in Christ. And once you begin to get that into place, then you begin to work on those other parts of your life that need a little order, that need a little change. But you just can't come into a church and say you're going to need to change your life and then think you can do it without first changing our hearts and really understanding why we teach and believe what we do.
When you talk about parts of people's lives that may need more order and in the context of the discussion we're having and where this discussion has gone, does that extend to people who are gay and who have what often the church calls a gay lifestyle? Is that something that you mean when you say people may need to change the order of their lives?
It's part of it, but you know, I would always start off by when I get into these questions with people, you know, I'm a gay man and I don't feel welcome, or I'm a divorced and remarried person, or I'm a person who's basically living in worldly wealth and has no need for any care for the poor or anything like that. How do I change? What are you asking me to do as that person? And I'd say, what I'm asking you first is to try and begin to believe in Jesus Christ, and then to listen to what the church has to say in these matters, and then begin to say, how can I find my way to this? We're all on various levels of the way.
And what's the this that you mean? Find my way to – what's this?
Well, it's a call to holiness in which we try and live of this world, but of the kingdom of God. For example, let's go back to the issue of gay, lesbian, transgender, but also let's keep it in the context of people who are living outside of marriage, people who are in many relationships going from place to place. Our church believes that the perfection of the expression of human sexuality is between a man and a woman in a committed, fruitful relationship open to children. That's the paradigm. Most of us struggle with getting there. You know, even people who are married, they could say there are times when I'm not all that committed because I'm human or there's brokenness there. But the paradigm is still there. And any kind of expression that doesn't quite – that doesn't match that to me would say, look, that doesn't necessarily mean that what we're striving for is wrong. It means that I'm not making it there. I'm not fully there. But am I a bad person? Am I a bad Catholic? No. I'm someone who's on the road trying to find my way to live in this life and in this world, even if I don't quite match up to what the church is calling me to do.
How do you then situate the Catholic Church in a place like Vermont, which is a very socially liberal state?
Sure.
The legislature just publicly reaffirmed its support of Roe v. Wade, for example, and a significant majority said in the vote they support Planned Parenthood and abortion rights. The state has allowed the marriage of same-sex partners since 2009. It instituted civil unions 15 years ago now. Those are two issues where the Catholic Church's teachings diverge from state laws and from the views of many, if not most, Vermonters, including many Vermonters who identify as Catholics. So how do you square the church's teachings with the social outlook and social fabric of Vermont?
I think the issues that you just raised are part of the environment. They're part of the culture right now. And I've spoken publicly about how we're a missionary church now, that we're called to go out into that culture and begin to lift up what is good and to expand upon that, but also to engage people in such a way that perhaps they would begin to reconsider the choices that they're making regarding some of these positions that you made. So, and being a missionary church, if I'm a missionary and I go into a new culture, I can't expect to start changing laws and start changing the way that culture is doing things. What I got to do is change hearts. And my hope is that the other thing that's great about Vermont is that it's such a socially connected state. And so there's so much social ministry going on. There's so many not-for-profits out there that are helping people. And there's just goodness here. And even if I might disagree a lot with positions like abortion, like assisted suicide, like the hot-button cultural war issues right now, that's not what I'm going to focus my my preaching on. My preaching is going to be, let's lift up the good. Let's grow in our love for Jesus. And then out of there, begin to talk about how we support families, how we support pregnant women, how we support people who are facing end-of-life issues, all those things, so that they begin to make choices that are perhaps different than they would have made in terms of assisted suicide or abortion. I understand that these are all very complex, and that, you know, the polls that you just recognized, you'd say that, you know, the vast majority of people would support, for example, abortion on demand. When you begin to pick that down, though, they'd also say, but not at the third trimester. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and that's not legal.
Right. Here in the state? Okay. So I see there I'm still learning these – you know, I'm saying even when there's – I didn't know that. I thought it was even –
Well, my understanding is that most third trimester abortions are not legal, that in the most cases it's earlier in the pregnancy where it's
right.
Legal. But to your point, there are certainly dimensions and different places where people even – where people have different opinions within an overarching idea of whether abortion should be legal or not, for example. I think that's where you were going.
Correct. Right? Correct.
So it's something like the assisted suicide. That is some of those laws are supposed to sunset this year, and the legislature will be discussing it. Are you a bishop who we're likely to see at the State House as those negotiations are happening?
No. I'm not a politician. I'm not a policymaker. If I'm asked to come and speak to the people what the Catholic Church's teaching on this would be, I would do so, and I would be more than willing to do so. What I hope to do is, as this issue gets closer, is to send out a letter to the people, to the Catholics of the state, and asking them to consider the gravity of the situation, to consider what we're dealing with. You know, Vermont, even prior to the passing of the law, Vermont had one of the highest suicide rates in the country. Like, there was like 3 percentage points above the median, and there's a lot of reasons for that. What happens, I think, when you begin to pass a law like the assisted suicide law, is that you create an environment that encourages, perhaps, unfortunately, encourages people who are dealing with mental issues and other issues that are treatable, that can be helped, to perhaps consider in a way they say, well, if it's legal for people who are suffering because of a physical illness, why isn't it legal for me for somebody who's suffering so badly because of mental illness? It creates a culture, I think, of suicide that I'd worry about that. You never want to see someone get to that situation. I'd like to think that we Catholics can be part of doing everything we can to help people not make that decision and to promote the well-being of all of our citizens and people in the state.
We're talking today with Bishop Christopher Coyne, the newly installed Bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington. We're going to take more of your questions coming right up. If you have a question for him about how he views the role of the Catholic Church in Vermont, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Bishop Christopher Coyne is the 10th bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington. He's with us today explaining his goals for the church and how he plans to strengthen the church's presence in the community. If you have a question for the new bishop, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Nick, who's calling in from Albany, New York. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Bishop Coyne and Jane, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question, I guess, or my inquiry is, recently, just over a month ago in December, the Vatican released the results of an apostolic look-see, I guess we call it. I'm not sure I would term it an investigation, of religious women in the United States. I think pointed a lot of it was in relationship to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, and the Vatican and Pope Francis exonerated the women from I think what was seen as the possible straying from the religious principles in some way and form. And I was just wondering if, Bishop, you would comment on that and perhaps make a statement relative to the participation of women religious relative to parish life ministries and other things.
Nick, thank you for your call. Bishop Coyne?
Well, you know, this is a kind of a bit of a landmine because in speaking what I'm about to say, I'm criticizing those who initially engaged in this investigation or visitation to the religious sisters in the United States. I thought in its essence, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but I thought the manner in which it was done was heavy-handed. I think it's always a good thing for people to perhaps have a look – to be invited to look at their lives and their religious communities and all that and see what are they doing. Again, I'll use what I've been saying. What are you doing well? What are we not doing well? But the problem was it seemed so much from on high that all of a sudden this group of men in Rome under the instigation of some folks here decide to target just this one group of religious. And, you know, we're not doing a visitation of the men religious at the same time. We're only looking at this group over here, but we're not looking at that group. Now, granted, the part of the concerns that was coming out was the complaints that were being raised about some of the alleged practices and beliefs of some of the women within this community.
My understanding is that a lot of people thought that this was sort of openly hostile towards nuns who were socially activist in a way, or that was the perception of the church.
Well,
is that accurate?
Yeah, I don't think it was because they were working with the poor or anything like that. I think it was because at times there were some people that they bring in to speak at their conventions or some of the positions that they'd hold publicly in terms of the church's teaching that they were saying they're not in agreement with. Having that been said, I think the best outcome was exactly what happened, that at the end this process ended, that the women I don't want to say exonerated because there was a lot of things they didn't need to be exonerated, but they were found to be, you know, living good communities of life. And then they were encouraged to perhaps look at those part of their lives that all of us need to look at in terms of strengthening our common goal as Catholics. That having been said, I look forward to continuing to work with the good religious men and women in the state of Vermont to foster the mission of the church. And I will do everything that I can to foster the consultation and the presence of women of all walks of life within the archdiocese, within the diocese, and especially in the administration of the diocese.
Especially in the administration, you say?
Yeah, I think part of what we deal with is that so often power and authority is caught up in the ordained clergy, and It's not just the fact that we're fulfilling a sacramental role, but we have this role of governance that just seems to limit at times the expression of that governance and administration and consultation and discernment to a bunch of celibate men. And I can well understand why married couples, non-celibate folks, and also, but most especially women would feel this just shouldn't be happening because we have a lot to say too, and we have a lot to offer too.
Is there any part of you though that would welcome women priests?
No. And the reason why I say no is because as a bishop, the Pope and others have said this is a closed question. And so my role is to continue to maintain the practice as it's put forward and to try and explain to folks why the church believes what it does and practices what it does in this matter.
There are a lot of areas which perhaps many thought were also closed where Pope Francis has really expanded the viewpoint of the church and has really been more open and perhaps welcoming to people of different stripes than previous popes have been. He certainly has presented himself in a different way. He's also come out and publicly admonished many in the Catholic leadership for not being as committed to helping the poor, to living lives that are that are a little bit cleaner and more simple than perhaps many people are living. How do you see the Pope's role in interacting with Catholics and with the rest of the world? What do you think of him?
I think Pope Francis, in the same way that Benedict and John Paul did, is a pastor and a father of the church who seeks to call us each to the Catholic Church's teaching. But what Benedict has done is he hasn't changed the content of what we believe and why we believe. He's changed the conversation in terms of how we engage the community out there, how we engage the wider world. He's got us to a place where we're talking about what we're for rather than what we're against. And so he's saying we're for the poor. We're for the marginalized. We're for those on the peripheries who feel left out. We want them to be part of our community. But when you start to kind of pick at it, you also realize that he's still very much a man of the church's doctrine and dogma. And he's not changing – at this point, he hasn't changed anything of substance so much as he's changed the way in which we talk about that and the way we engage each other.
There were 26 official cases of priest child abuse in Vermont. And SNAP, the survivors network of those abused by priests, has called on you to reach out to adults who were abused by people in the Catholic Church, whether they're priests or not. Is that something that you plan to do?
Absolutely. I was a bit disconcerted to see that I was being accused of not having done that because I actually did that in Indianapolis. And since I hadn't even had my feet on the ground here, I don't know where that was coming from. Anyone who has been abused by a priest or religious or the person themselves or their families who wishes to talk to me, who wants to let me hear their story, I am more than willing to do that because I want to do everything that I can to continue hopefully the healing, the spiritual healing that is so necessarily a part of this matter as well.
I guess that might be the distinction. It sounds to me from their press release like what SNAP is asking for is not for you to be welcoming to anybody who reaches out to you, but for specifically for you and for the diocese to be doing reach out to those who may have been abused. Is that – I mean, I don't know how you do that if you don't know who they are, but how – I mean, how do you address that issue?
Well, we have an office right now that's continuing to deal with victims. We have people that are continuing to receive counseling that's paid for by the Diocese of Burlington. And our folks on the ground know these people. They know their names. I suspect probably one of the best ways is to say, hey, is there anybody that you know of right now that could probably use a conversation with me? Can you give them a call and see if they want to come and talk, if they want me to come to them? I could just continue to make the invitation and say, if you want to talk to me about this matter, if you need to talk to me about this matter, then please, please contact our office and I'll be more than willing to do so.
Let's go to Elizabeth calling in from Pulteney. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling because I was an employee of Vermont Catholic Charities as a therapist for 10 years. And during the fiasco of the priest, I do believe that we were taken advantage of, and I also believe that there was a lot of things that happened after I quit. Let's say I left my position before many people were let go. And I believe and am wishing that there would be some formal apology, that maybe we would be all invited back to discuss the way we were treated as therapists, as professional people during what I call a fiasco.
What about that, Bishop Coyne?
Well, you know, part of the issue about coming from another state is you don't really know the whole story. And I'm not saying at all that the caller was off base in what she's saying. I just don't know what happened. And I'm only beginning to hear the kind of narrative of all this that's been part of the life of the church here in Burlington. Certainly, if there is a need for this kind of a meeting and it's going to bring about some healing and reconciliation with the church, again, I'm open to that. I think, though, the most important thing for the first year is to me to hear exactly what I just heard. And if there's many voices that are saying the same thing, then we're going to have to address that.
Are you going to be involved in the financial matters of the church? The church did have – the diocese had to sell off two prime pieces of real estate to pay $20 million in child abuse settlements. There have been financial issues with the diocese. Is that something that you plan to be involved in as the bishop?
Right away, I will be for the first year or so. I was the vicar general in Indianapolis, which meant I was basically the COO, so I was very much a part of all of this. So I have my hand around a lot of how it works. My first year here, I've already said I would like to be involved in the budget process for each department, only because when I've been involved in the budget process, I've learned so much. Like, I didn't know we were doing that, or I didn't know we were paying for that, or what's this over here? So it's informational. But we have people in place who are doing good work as far as our finances. I want to continue to maintain that.
That's Bishop Christopher Coyne. He's the 10th bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington. Thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, our monthly book club for young readers, Dorothy's List, returns on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And it's time now for Dorothy's List, our monthly book club for kids based on books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. This month we go to Moortown, where some 4th, 5th, and 6th graders have been reading a novel by Rita Williams Garcia. The title comes from a bit of advice that's passed on through family letters. The book is called P.S. B11. It's the second book in a trilogy about one family's experience during a time of social and cultural change. VPR's Amy Noyes was there when the author visited the Moortown School Library.
P.S. B11 takes place in a very different time and place from modern-day Moortown, Vermont. The book's three sisters live in Brooklyn, New York, in the late 1960s with their pa and their grandmother, who they call Big Ma. But their mother lives in Oakland, California, where she's involved with the radical civil rights group, the Black Panthers. The Gaither sisters got to know their mother in the first book in the series, called One Crazy Summer. In PSB 11, the oldest sister, Delphine, writes letters to her mother, Cecile, and her reply always comes back with a reminder not to grow up too quickly. Like the Gaither sisters, author Rita Williams Garcia also lives in New York City, and she spends time in central Vermont teaching at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. While she was here, she made time to stop by Moortown and get to know some of her young readers. A group of 4th, 5th, and 6th graders at the Moortown School meet once a week during lunch with teacher librarian Meg Allison to read books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. The students were excited to meet the author and had lots of questions ready for her, including 5th grader Madison Bird.
Why did you name it PSB 11 and how come in the letters it said PSB 11? What inspired you to do that?
Okay, it occurs to me that Cecile has missed out on a lot of Delphine as she was growing up. So she really got to spend time with her as an 11-year-old. And I bet you she wish she had more of that time. But the main reason why I do that is because Delphine is writing, usually sometimes angrily, to her mother, and then her mother will write back the answer and explain things. And so she's always kind of saying, you are 11 years old. Enjoy being 11 while you can. Don't rush it, you know. Childhood is a gift. And if you could just enjoy it for as long as you can, then that's a gift that a parent would want to give to a child. And I think that's why she says be 11, even when she's 12.
Why does the story take place in 1969?
Actually, I was around during that time. I was near your age. I was about, let's see, how old was I? I think I was 12 in 1969. And what I remember was that so many different things were happening. I guess just like now, there's so many different things happening in the news. And I was always watching the news, but I didn't have to see the news to know that things were happening. Things were changing in my neighborhood. They were changing everywhere. You had more women going into the workforce, which was different. You had girls who wanted to play sports that were traditionally boys' sports. So you had Title IX. I wanted to play football. So, you know, I connected to that. You had strife between people. They didn't understand each other. And so you had riots. You had just all kinds of things. And you had protests, lots of protests. So there was so many things going on. I figured, okay, this is a good place to tell a story because there's an awful lot of change. And when things change, people change. And so I wanted to think about how all of those changes affected these three girls, especially Delphine.
In P.S. B11, Delphine has contended with big changes, like her uncle coming home very different from when he left for war in Vietnam, and smaller changes, like getting ready for the sixth grade dance. And then there's the fact that her father has started dating. Here's Moortown fifth grader Hannah Ledoux.
What inspired you to write PSB 11?
The girls met their mother, and now they were going to be in their home environment. And I would think that wouldn't one of them, or at least Delphine, the viewpoint character, wouldn't she wonder, why couldn't they be together? Why couldn't their mother and father be together? And so when her father starts whistling My Girl and wearing cologne and announces that there's someone special in his life, not only special, but then she's going to become a part of the family, that then creates a kind of an obstacle for Delphine, who really does want her parents to be together. And I think that a lot of us do experience that maybe our parents love each other, but they can't be together. And so that might be very hard to understand. So I think I wanted to talk about how that family is getting ready to change, just as the neighborhood is changing and the world around them is changing. I thought, well, let's talk about personal change as well.
The main character, Delphine, has two younger sisters, Vonetta and Fern. And without their mother around, Delphine has always been responsible for helping to take care of her little sisters. Fourth grader Cammie Rochelieu wanted to know about Williams Garcia's own family.
Do you have any siblings, like any family or siblings?
Do I have any siblings? Actually, I have an older brother, Russell, and an older sister, Rosalyn. So we are Rita, Rosalyn, and Russell. So that would make me the youngest. And being the youngest, they would say, oh, she's the baby. She gets everything and she doesn't get into trouble. But being the youngest, I would say, you know, they're always picking on me, but, you know, one day I'm going to get bigger and taller and they'll see. I'll show them. So we played a lot together and we fought a lot together, but we were very close, very peas in a pod.
In PSB 11, the band The Jackson 5 are all the rage, and fifth grader Eloise Harris took notice.
Why did you choose The Jackson 5?
Why did I choose The Jackson 5? Oh my goodness gracious. Okay, so what boy bands do you all like?
One Direction.
Okay. So, back when I was a kid, a lot of the groups that I listened to and kids in my neighborhood, we listened to a lot of Motown. But if you look at the Motown artists, they're like old men. Well, to us, they were old men. They were probably like 25, 30, you know. But when we finally saw kids who were like our age, we just screamed and went crazy. So the Jackson 5 were kind of like one of the first boy bands that appealed, especially to African Americans. They had a universal appeal, but especially to African Americans, and the first like real crushes that we had on boys who looked like boys that we might see in our neighborhood. So that was a big part of it. And also, my sister and I wanted to go to Madison Square Garden to see the Jackson 5, but my mother said, "Are you kidding? We're not Rockefeller. We don't have all of that money." So I wanted my girls to go. I wanted Delphine, Vanetta, and Fern to go.
As these young readers talk to the author about her novel, they start to wonder what she was like at their age. Fifth grader Jonah Busker.
Did you have a favorite writer growing up and why?
I loved Beverly Cleary because she had kind of a neighborhood of stories. I felt like I was in her neighborhood and knowing the stories and the kids. And I really liked that the kids really struggled. Ramona could be a bit of a pest, and I had an older sister and I was kind of a pest. Ribsy was, I think, was one of the first stories that I felt like I could feel myself just really in the story and loving that dog, and that he was not a perfect show dog, but just a kind of a, you know, scrappy dog. So I just loved how she captured not the most perfect people, but the most real people. I really like that.
PSB 11 and One Crazy Summer are the first two books in a trilogy. Fourth grader Nathan Kudrivitz wanted to know what happens next for the Gaither sisters.
Do you think you want to make another book on to PSB 11?
Yes, I did. And it's called Gone Crazy in Alabama. And it actually follows the girls. Well, they've been to Oakland. They've traveled back to the East. And now they're going to go south and visit with Big Ma and her mother. So we get to see all these different generations of the Trotters, Gaithers, and Charles. So that's what this book is.
The kids at the Moortown School got to see an advanced copy of Gone Crazy in Alabama. It will be released in April. That's about the time that students in Vermont will be voting on the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award, which PSB 11 is nominated for. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
Next month on Dorothy's List, The Center of Everything by Vermont author Linda Urban. For 11-year-old Ruby Pepperdine, The Center of Everything is up on the rooftop of Pepperdine Motors in her town of Bunning, New Hampshire, stargazing with her grandmother Gigi. Here's Cabot School 7th grader Billy O'Connor reading from The Center of Everything.
If you were from someplace other than this particular part of New Hampshire and were driving through Bunning on your way to Canada or to Santa's Village in Jefferson or simply to take in the autumn foliage, you might not even notice Pepperdine Motors. Actually, unless you were in the market for a great deal on a new or used vehicle, Pepperdine Motors probably would not be much of an interest to you. It was of great interest to Ruby Pepperdine, however. Not for the low, low prices, or for the box of delicious donuts in the waiting room, or for the twice-yearly Moonlit Madness sale. Pepperdine Motors was of great interest to Ruby Pepperdine because the roof was flat. And on Sunday nights, after Gigi closed the repair shop, and Dad closed the showroom, and Aunt Lois closed the office, Gigi would turn off the big fluorescent lights that flooded the car lot, and she and Ruby would climb the staircase to the roof, and they would look at the stars.
That's an excerpt from The Center of Everything. It's the next book in our monthly series, Dorothy's List. You can learn more at vpr.net. Click on Dorothy's List. This series is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. And finally today, an announcement of a new award for Vermont books and authors. The Vermont College of Fine Arts, in partnership with independent booksellers around the state, is sponsoring the Vermont Book Award. In an exclusive interview with Vermont Edition, College of Fine Arts President Thomas Christopher Green says the award fills a gap in the landscape.
Well, I actually thought it was a real omission that there wasn't a Vermont Book Award. And it came to my attention because this is high literary award season right now. And I know that Massachusetts has a Massachusetts Book Award. There's a New England Book Award. but it seemed to me an oversight that there wasn't a particular Vermont Book Award. You know, you see the quality of fiction and poetry and children's writing and even nonfiction that's produced in this state. You know, there was over 40 books published by Vermont authors by major houses last year alone. That's really extraordinary for a state of our size.
Nominations will come in from publishers and booksellers, and the judging panel will be made up of local writers, booksellers, and librarians. The award will go to a Vermont author or the author of a book set in Vermont, and it comes with a $5,000 purse.
I think anything makes a difference to working writers in Vermont, but that's actually a fairly significant prize for a literary award. Many of them are $1,500, $2,500. We wanted to make it significant enough that we hope it would buy them some more time to write, but also to acknowledge, I think, the significance of the contribution they're making to letters in the state.
In announcing the award today, Green says Vermont plays a special role in fostering good writing, particularly fiction. He says we're a web of small towns, and where neighbors know one another, interesting things happen, and that ends up in novels. The first winner of the Vermont Book Award will be announced this fall. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, the story of Vermont. You can't get an accurate picture of the state if you don't look at its natural and cultural histories together. In the book, The Story of Vermont, authors Steve Trombulak and Chris McGrory-Kleiza explain how the landscape and inhabitants have influenced one another. They'll talk with us tomorrow on the program at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.